From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Ever since the COVID-19 pandemic threw hundreds of thousands of North Carolinians out of work, the state has faced problems with the timely payment of unemployment. You'll hear highlights from a recent legislative debate on the topic. State lawmakers are committing more money for enrollment growth in North Carolina's public schools, but some legislators question whether that makes sense during the pandemic. COVID-19 has attracted new attention to the need for healthcare innovation. You'll hear ideas for getting government out of the way. And we'll analyze the selection of a new president for the University of North Carolina. His name is Peter Hans. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us, and she has the Carolina Journal headline.
More than 1,500 hours of classroom instruction, plus a year's worth of apprenticeship. Now, that is our state's outsized requirement for becoming a barber in North Carolina. So why such a heavy burden for this profession? Well, the ugly origins of North Carolina's barber licensing requirement is the subject of a fascinating piece written by John Sanders. John is Director of Regulatory Studies here at the John Locke Foundation. He joins me now to talk about some history and some rules that we really should be looking at very carefully. John, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Donna.
What caught your eye about this? In other words, why did you decide to write about the heavy burden of licensing on barbers?
Well, because we have gotten into the question of looking at what kind of training police have, and it was brought up before the General Assembly that, you know, we require over 1,500 hours for barbers to be trained, and we don't require near that much for policemen. And the thrust of those comments was, the state is more interested in making sure barbers get more training than police. But knowing the history of the barber's license, these are two completely separate issues. And we don't want to be applying those kind of standards to police. Definitely, we need to look at police training, and those need to be the sorts of issues that people need to look at, but not in the context of why, you know, barbers get more training than police. The reason barbers have so much training is a pretty ugly history.
It really is. And so you were listening to this discussion about this ongoing discussion that we're having in our country about police and policing. And when you heard that comment made at the General Assembly, you kind of separated that out from the discussion of police training and said, you know, this really has some history to it here in our state that we should talk about and try to move forward from. As you mentioned, it's an ugly history, and it dates back decades. Tell us about why North Carolina barbers have such a heavy burden in order to practice their trade.
Well, it goes back to the progressives and progressive racism, unfortunately. Barber's licenses aren't the only sort of thing. We've looked at other policies here, but in the 19th century, after the Civil War was ended in emancipation, former slaves were going to work for themselves. And one of the things where they were very successful at was in barbering. And in North Carolina and many other places, the majority of barbers were blacks. And the way that they were building themselves up as entrepreneurs and building their communities and reinvesting was through this trade. One of the biggest examples is John Merrick from Durham, who ended up founding North Carolina Mutual to help insure blacks. So it was a wonderful example of entrepreneurship in America. But the white barbers decided they didn't like this competition, and they wanted somehow legally to put their black competitors out of business. And so what they did was they went to the state to regulate, and they made it where you needed to go to school and you needed to accomplish so much apprenticeship, and you needed to be able to fill out testing. And these struck at chords of racism within North Carolina, within the United States. This was not just a North Carolina thing. This was all over the United States.
So these rules made it very difficult for anyone. But in this case, you're saying that it really went back to people in this state and others who held very reprehensible, ugly views about African Americans at that time. And in order to try to essentially keep them out of being successful and earning a living and supporting their families, they tried to make it really, really tough. So they added all of these rules of all sorts of licenses and or hours of instruction, etc. But what is also interesting is that even with those barriers up, there were people of all races who said, okay, that's a tough hill to climb, but I can do that. And they went ahead and did.
Well, they did. The reason it was a problem for blacks, though, was because in the South at the time, especially, they weren't given the same sort of educational opportunities. They were not given the same sort of professional opportunities. So it kind of struck at them in a way that, you know, looked on paper legally to be just valid and not race-based, but the intent was definitely race-based.
So, John, this story, and you've written about it in a very interesting way, and people can read this piece at johnlock.org to read more about the history, but you also make a larger point, and that is that to this day, we have all sorts of unfair, anti-competitive rules in place for barbers and hosts of other professions that make it really tough for people to earn a living. And that is one of your points as well, to look at the barber situation, but also to realize that to this day we have unfair rules.
Absolutely. I mean, my response to the standards police versus barbering was, well, why in the world do we require over 1,500 hours for barbers? Of training plus another year. I mean, most states don't even go that far. But we have the same problem in a lot of professions in North Carolina where we require occupational licensing. The General Assembly just recently passed a bill that will make it easier for veterans and their spouses and military spouses who moved to North Carolina to get a job, because licensing makes it hard for them to do that, but they have to move around a lot. So they don't have the time to acquire the standards that the state's requiring.
You know, John, you have also written previously about ways to address this, to move forward so that people can have an easier time to practice their skill or their trade and support themselves, earn a living, raise their family, and all of that, that doesn't require actual licensing. But here's the pushback that we hear a lot. People will say, well, we need to have all of these rules in place because whether it's barbers or other professions, they have the potential to hurt people. It's a public health question or a public safety question. But you write that there are other ways that could protect everyone.
Well, most professions have professional certification organizations that will ensure those sorts of things. And that's part of the training. And you can have disclosure to your clients, that you show what kind of certification that you have. And if without licensing in many of these instances, there will be a greater push for that because consumers will want to know, and you will want as a provider to advertise, you know, you're really good at this. You know what you're doing.
And so, John, it's very interesting, the piece that you wrote, not only about what's happening with barbers in North Carolina, and to this day, this is the incredible burden, the requirement in order to become a barber in this state. John, is there any appetite in the General Assembly to actually cut this back?
With respect to barbers, I don't think so. However, there is a bill right now for universal license recognition, which Arizona and recently Iowa have passed, which is a good idea.
John, thanks for sharing this. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The COVID-19 pandemic has generated more than 1 million unemployment claims in North Carolina. It's also generated multiple complaints about the state's unemployment system. During a recent hearing, Republican State Senator Chuck Edwards highlighted the problems.
Our citizens have been told that they can't work, and in turn for their cooperation, we've promised them that we'd help. About 1.2 million folks have reached out and sought our help, so that they can pay their rent and feed their families. To date, about 540,000 of those claims are being paid. My office and the office of most other legislators is working overtime, listening to the frustration of those that are still asking for our help. The first call that I answered this morning was from a lady back at home that said she's been trying for weeks to get into the queue. She spends a couple of hours at a time, gets kicked out, then calls back and says that she can't be put in the queue at that time. And let's be honest, there's no way that anybody could have anticipated that we would have found ourselves in the crisis that we're facing today. And so it would have been impossible to build a system to deal with this.
Lawmakers listened to public complaints. Linda Money has been working to help unemployed workers file for benefits.
From what we were seeing, mobile devices such as smartphones and tablets were extremely unreliable with signing in and filling out information. And as the system had more and more users, even the computers were having a hard time navigating an already difficult program. The program itself is not user-friendly at all. There are too many pages to switch between. The questions are not straightforward, and too many questions are repeated. Errors or issues are not explained to let people know what's needed to be done or uploaded to correct the problems. The list goes on and on.
Anthony Martin shared his own story of trying to secure unemployment benefits.
My personal nightmare began April 17th when I got a call that I was going to be furloughed for a month. Initially, I was furloughed for a month, and immediately I got on the DES website to file the claim. That's when the problems all started. I filled out everything to the best of my knowledge and thought I was on the right path. I was wrong. I began signing on every day to see if anything had updated, and I noticed there was a fact-finding issue that needed to be cleared up. However, clicking on the link did nothing but say null. That's when I knew I needed help, so I started calling in. The first time I called, it took hundreds of tries just to get into a hold queue, only to be told by the person on the other end that I needed to speak with a DES agent. I was then transferred to a message that told me to call back later.
Randy Novia shared her own unemployment horror story.
I was furloughed on April 4th to no fault of my own because of COVID-19. I applied for unemployment insurance that day, the first day that I could. My situation, I am being paid one day a week during furlough to cover my medical benefits for my family. I had questions and needed clarification, so that's when I started calling the DES helpline. No clarification was available. I was, like Anthony, not able to get into the hold queue, so I started filing my weekly certification. After 2 weeks of pending status, I started emailing most of you in the room. It shouldn't be like that. I shouldn't have to email. I still haven't gotten a hold queue. To get back pay, I've called 4 to 5 hours per day, again, not even able to get into the hold queue. Thank you for your time today, and thank you for your help. But we're better than this. It should be easier for everyone out there in North Carolina during furlough or layoffs. Nobody should have to call you all weekend and leave messages and email all of you. We're better than this, and we should make it better for all of us.
You're listening to highlights from a recent legislative hearing on North Carolina's struggling unemployment system. John Challis cited the problems his auto parts manufacturing business faced. The company tried to file a so-called attachment claim for all of its workers.
Unfortunately, the attached claims work in some cases, but in some cases they have not worked. We have employees that have not been paid yet, and they have been out since the first week of April. The first week of April, they haven't been able to pay their rent. They haven't been able to buy groceries. In my 30 years or 31 years now in NGK, I have never asked anybody to go to the food, Christian mission. Never. Until this time.
Restaurant owner Mary Ann Lewis struggled to get basic information about unemployment claims.
We closed the restaurant on March 17th, furloughed all but two of our staff. So 16 people were furloughed on the 17th. On the 19th, three of those staff started the application process for unemployment. By April 3rd, we had to hire one of those staff back so they could sit on the telephone to try and get our employee identification number. We had received from the Unemployment Commission letters, request for separation, and at the top, underneath, it says EAN. There is no explanation. We have no or minimal experience with the Unemployment Security Commission. We were not aware that that was actually our employer identification number. There is no place on the website that explains that this is how it appears, and so we thought we had to call in to get that number and the associated PIN number, which we were informed that we had to do over the phone. We then, on Monday, April 6th, not getting through, all of the phone systems kept crashing. The computer system also crashed. I see a failure in this. Long-range planning is what you are hired and representatives to do. It is not sexy. It doesn't bring in the votes. It doesn't play well to the public. It saves lives.
Julie Savage had a hard time telling the story of her husband's layoff.
We are a family of six, and unemployment has yet to acknowledge us. I'm sorry. If we didn't have his retirement, we would lose our home. We don't even want unemployment. We just want our jobs back. Our nation didn't close down during the Spanish flu, which is H1N1. There's still not even a cure for H1N1. And my husband is a physician assistant. We don't wear masks. It's not healthy. Herd immunity is what is healthy. Closing us down is destroying our economy. And I know this is so much bigger than Governor Cooper. This is powers that are just trying to shut down America, and we are Americans, and we need to look out for each other.
Lana Witt touched on a larger theme beyond a personal tale of unemployment system problems.
This isn't about politics. This isn't about unemployment insurance. This is about people having gifts, talents, and skills that they want to use in their communities. You have been stripped of your power to represent the people where you live. You represent local communities, cities, counties, and our state. And I apologize that our governor has not trusted you to represent us and put us back to work. We can do our jobs with integrity. We can take care of one another, and we can honor not just you as you represent us and put us back to work, but we can honor one another and keep one another healthy. Anything that we can do to help you and empower you and give you political courage to stand up against this so that the unemployment office can get back to doing their job, which is to take care of those who are unemployed on occasion, not for months on end, not for an indefinite amount of time, not with an undisclosed pattern for how we're going to reopen.
You've been listening to highlights from a recent legislative hearing. It tackled problems within North Carolina's unemployment insurance system. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina lawmakers are adding millions of dollars for new public school enrollment, but some of them have concerns. Representative John Fraley recently questioned a proposal involving $75 million.
It just doesn't make sense to me that we reserve $75 million that's supposed to cover the public schools, community colleges, and UNC, and is taking the entire $75 million just for public education. Also, at a time when the general thinking is, or what has happened recently, is that we've seen the ADM in public education to be somewhat flat. We've seen it increase in community colleges, and we're seeing it come down, you know, in the university level. Now, granted, there's a lot of things that are in flux as it relates to where people are going to go to school this fall. So I can understand that somebody's got to make some, you know, judgment calls on that. But this one seems a little heavy to me.
Top House budget writer Donnie Lambeth responded to Fraley's concern.
We quizzed and quizzed and quizzed because I agreed with you, and I think several of us did, that this didn't make sense that the enrollment would be growing at a level at that rate. Actually, we quizzed them so hard they came back and increased it. And so I share your concern, and I don't know that we can get a better answer in a short time, but we scrubbed and scrubbed and tried to figure out, because intuitively it didn't make sense to, I think, many of our committee as well as when we were looking at it.
Representative Craig Horn discussed one potential impact of the COVID-19 pandemic.
A lot of people out of work, many of the kids that have been in private schools or other alternatives to traditional public schools, the reality is they're going to be returning to traditional public schools just because families cannot afford to continue them in parochial or private schools. So there's an anticipation that we're going to have an enrollment bump. The reality is we don't know.
Representative Larry Pittman thinks the pandemic might have an opposite effect.
In making these considerations, has anybody thought about the possibility that some of these parents have found out during this situation that they actually can teach their kids at home, and they may be homeschooling going forward instead of sending them back to the public schools? I mean, that's a possibility, too, that ought to be looked at, I think.
You've been listening to State House Committee debate about new funding for public school enrollment in North Carolina. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Healthcare issues, of course, are at the top of the agenda for many in North Carolina, and one of the groups that's focusing on policies in the state is the Foundation for Government Accountability. Joining us now to talk about some of the big issues in healthcare is Josh Archambault. He is senior fellow at FGA. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Mitch.
One of the things that you have been working on is increasing this option of direct healthcare. First of all, before we talk about what can be done, remind us, how is that different from the traditional setup that we're all used to?
Sure. So for most people who have employer-based insurance, let's say, they go to the doctor and the doctor gets paid for each of those visits. And then they wait. And then they wait, and then they get something in the mail, and they get very nervous because it's from their health insurance company, and maybe they owe a $30 copay, or actually maybe they owe the entire visit. It's really a crapshoot on what's going to show up in the mail. And what it really is driven by is what insurance plan that you are on. And depending on your deductible level and your cost sharing, it really is very different for different people, and you don't find out usually 30 to 60 days later. So that has led to all sorts of problems in healthcare. But moving in this direction of direct healthcare, it's really you make a contract with an individual provider or a group and you pay them a monthly fee. It's very transparent. You pay them, and there's all sorts of benefits that can come of this model that we can talk about. But the main thing is certainty. There's no surprise bills. There's no big bills. You're not waiting. You know what it's going to cost every month or for the entire year.
And because of that, you also know what you're paying. It isn't something where, I kind of think I'm paying this, but I'm not really sure. You know what the bill is.
Correct. Yeah. And probably the most familiar that people may be with direct healthcare arrangement is direct primary care. So primary care providers. And usually the fees there are somewhere roughly around $50 to $100 a month, depending on how large your family size is or what the practice offers. But again, very transparent. You know exactly what you're paying for up front.
What are you working on that front in North Carolina?
Yeah, so, there are direct primary care providers here in North Carolina, and perhaps some of your listeners use those, and they can see the value. But really, primary care doesn't need to be limited here for the direct arrangement. There's an opportunity here, whether it's a physical therapist, whether it's for mental health procedures, anything in which an ongoing relationship with a specialist, the direct healthcare arrangement would be beneficial. So we're trying to make sure that the state law allows for and clearly says, and this is the technical piece, this is not insurance because there's not a transfer of risk. It's not like a health insurance company. It's just saying we need to have a contract, be very specific about what's included in it, but have all of those benefits that people may be familiar with direct primary care and John Locke has written about so great in the past, extended into specialty care.
We are speaking with Josh Archambault, who is senior fellow at the Foundation for Government Accountability. Tied into this, in some respects, is something that is sometimes called telemedicine or telehealth. What are you working on that front?
Yeah, it actually ties in very nicely because a lot of direct primary care doctors use telehealth currently as a way to increase access for people to be able to be in contact with their provider without always having to come into the office. So there is a in an age of coronavirus and other concerns, telehealth has really been pushed to the forefront. And North Carolina doesn't have a lot on the books when it comes to telehealth. There's actually – there's not even a formal definition of what it is. Now, the legislature has passed a bill. Both chambers have passed a bill, and they're in a conference committee. But there's some opportunities here. And one of the primary opportunities is to make sure that people can use telehealth across state lines. So we can think of a number of situations where practically this would be helpful. Let's say a parent moves home with you. You know, they're retired or they have some health needs, they move home. Well, if they lived in another state and had providers there that were know them well, know their health needs, have a long-term relationship, they're currently not allowed to continue to see your parents unless they have a North Carolina medical license. And so we want to say, if that provider knows this patient well, if they are in good standing in their home state, then they should be able to continue to see that patient through telehealth. Not for all of their healthcare needs, but for where it's appropriate. And so we want to make sure that we have a more flexible healthcare system to increase access in rural communities where there are simply not enough providers. So maybe somebody has diabetes, endocrinologists, there's not a lot of them. So maybe this is an opportunity for somebody to connect with an endocrinologist who lives 50 miles away or 3,000 miles away. Maybe they can be a good person for them to help better manage their diabetes, which is going to help the patient and help that person's family in the long term.
We've touched on this a bit already, but one of the issues that's tied to these types of innovations is this idea of increasing medical price transparency. What are you working on that front?
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of conversation about this. There's some new federal rules that the Trump administration has put forward, both for hospitals and insurance companies. You know, states play a big role in this too, making sure that they pass laws that say that individuals should be able to see what the real price is ahead of time. As
shocker.
I know. It's really, you know, in any other area of our industry, in industries, we expect this. You don't go to the grocery store and don't see prices. You actually want to know what the price is going to be. And so a number of states have passed laws, and we'd encourage North Carolina to step forward in this regard as well and say that patients ahead of time should be able to see the real prices that their insurance company, if they're insured, is going to pay. If they're uninsured, what the cash price will be, and they should be able to compare between providers so they can choose. And just to put a fine point on this, the price differences between parking your car in different parking spaces can be tens of thousands of dollars for the exact same procedure or service. I think it seems only fair, as people are anxious about medical debt and bills, that we let them know what something's going to cost ahead of time.
There are a lot of different ideas that are floating about in the healthcare reform world. As you work in North Carolina, are you hearing a lot of receptiveness to this? I mean, is this the type of thing where you meet with legislators and policymakers and they say, yeah, this is something we should look at, or are many of these ideas ending up in the circular file?
You know, I think there's a ton of interest because as these legislators are going back home for Chamber of Commerce, breakfasts or lunches, this is the number one issue that they're hearing about. It's healthcare, healthcare, healthcare all day long. And so I think everybody recognizes, even if they disagree on perhaps some of the policy solutions to get there, we need reform. And so there's been a lot of interest, and maybe it's just a question of timing more than anything else, or how far the legislature feels like they're able to go in one session versus the next. But we're very optimistic about the reception that we have heard from legislators of, we understand there's a problem on high healthcare costs, and I actually want to do what's right for my constituents on this issue.
We've touched on several different things. As you get ready for the General Assembly coming back, or thinking ahead to, you know, what might not get done this year, but what to look forward to in the next session after 2021, what are the top priorities? What's number one or number one and number two on your list for North Carolina to do?
Yeah, I think we've talked about some of them today. It's really reducing uncertainty for patients. There's, as we've done lots of survey work and focus groups, this is where the American public is. They want more certainty going forward. So that certainly gets to price transparency, and that certainly gets to the direct healthcare issue that we talked about. I think the other one is access or options. Are we able as patients to be able to see the right provider at the right time? And that gets into some of the issues around telehealth, making sure that if your family member gets sick with coronavirus and the expert for coronavirus is next door in the state next door, that you have a way to be able to touch base with them through telemedicine instead of having it be illegal for them to see you as a patient because they don't have a license here.
Josh Archambault is Senior Fellow at the Foundation for Government Accountability. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day: jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Well, it is a new gig for an old hand at higher education in North Carolina. Peter Hans has been elected unanimously by the UNC Board of Governors to serve as the new president of the UNC system. Hans will leave his job as president of the state community college system to take the new opportunity. So what should we expect? For that, we turn to Jenna Robinson. Jenna is president of the Martin Center for Academic Renewal. That organization monitors and researches higher education policy in North Carolina. Jenna, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be here, Donna.
So how would you describe Peter Hans?
Peter is knowledgeable, personable, experienced. As you said, you know, he's an old hand. He's been around higher education circles for a very long time. And, you know, he knows the players and he knows the policies that are important.
What attracted the Board of Governors to him? Now, obviously, those are positive characteristics you just mentioned, but certainly the UNC system was doing a nationwide search. Mm-hmm. Presumably, a lot of very talented, experienced people would have wanted this type of job. Mm-hmm. So what was special about Peter Hans?
I think that what stands out to me about Peter is that he is a very easy person to work with. Not to say that, you know, he'll just go along with whatever, but that I think they're looking for a more harmonious relationship over at UNC. Things have been very tumultuous. People have, you know, there have been animosities. And I think that Peter is the right person in this situation to deal with that. He has a way of talking to people and engaging in discussion and discourse that I think is going to be a very valuable skill going forward.
He's actually served on the Board of Governors.
He was. He was board chair for a long time, and he was board chair when most of the other people on the board were, in fact, Democrats. And so he has dealt with what could have been a discordant situation in the past. And in my memory, at least, it was pretty harmonious when Peter was board chair.
You mentioned that the Board of Governors has been going through a tumultuous time. They've had several people leave the board. Jenna, is it fair to say that what has occurred is really a function of new blood on the Board of Governors that didn't want to just be a rubber stamp? Or have we actually had some people who just didn't want to get along and function as a board member?
You know, I think it was mostly what you said at first. New blood on the Board of Governors that want to exercise their oversight in a meaningful way. And that hasn't been kind of characteristic of the board for a very long time. They have been a rubber stamp. But I think that what else has happened is they've had to deal with some very, very contentious issues. Silent Sam at UNC comes to my mind immediately. I mean, that issue is fraught. It's sensitive. People are in kind of heightened states of emotion over that issue. And so I think that that lent itself to discord.
Tell us about Peter's accomplishments at the community college system, which he will leave as the CEO there to take the gig at the UNC system.
So Peter at the community college system has had to deal with some similar issues that he'll see at UNC. One of those is the very different nature or the varied nature of the different community colleges. There has been, you know, there's a wide variety of quality in our community college system of the students that they attract, of the problems that community college contend with, and having to deal with that diversity of institutions, I think will be very good experience going into UNC. And also having to deal with what does success look like for the community college. That's something that's hard to really wrap your hands around because community college students are coming in for a variety of reasons. But defining success and measuring it and moving towards a measure of success for students is something that he worked on at the community colleges. And again, that's part of the strategic plan for UNC, and he'll see that again.
Many different diverse campuses in the UNC system. There are more campuses in the community college system,
right,
but very different organizations in the UNC system. How is he going to reach out to all of them and essentially say, look, I understand your unique characteristics and I want to work with you?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think he can, in this one instance, take a page out of Margaret Spelling's book, and that is to go to each one in person. I don't know with COVID how easy that's going to be to do right now. Maybe he'll do it via Zoom.
And she's the former president of
the
system.
Right, exactly. But I think going to campuses, talking with those chancellors, which he knows most of them already. So he starts from a better position than some past presidents in that he knows the system. He knows its characteristics already. But working with them to set the individual metrics for how they achieve the strategic plan that the system as a whole is looking towards. And I think that having a set of diverse institutions, although it's, you know, maybe harder to handle, is, you know, better for the state because different universities can excel in different things and they don't have to all be, you know, cookie cutter universities that all offer exactly the same thing.
Well, speaking of metrics and achievement, he has a very interesting compensation package. Carolina Journal reporting that he's going to make a base salary of $400,000 a year, but he has the potential to earn up to $600,000 additional dollars per year based on this incentive plan that seems to be built around several key metrics. Tell us about those.
So the very first metric is graduation rates, and that's kind of the aerial view of what it is. The individual metrics are going to be set with the Board of Governors. So what that looks like when they're looking at whether he's meeting his goals hasn't been set yet. So we don't know whether it's going to be an increase in graduation rates across the board or meeting it in certain areas. You know, that is still up in the air. They are going to concentrate on transfer students and first year students, where again, I think he'll have an advantage coming from the community college system,
right,
knowing what those transfers look like. But I think that's one that we know the broad terms, but we don't know the details yet. The other thing that they're going to be looking at is education and related spending, you know, spending per degree, how to get that down. And he's mentioned that the community college system knows how to stretch a dollar, and he wants to apply that to the UNC system.
Also, he's going to be evaluated on issues of student loan debt. Tell us about that.
I think that, you know, that's one where I'm not sure how much he's going to be able to affect that. Graduation rates are the major determinant of whether a student can actually pay back their loans. But how much they borrow is in large part something that, you know, he can't control a lot of those variables. So that'll be interesting to watch.
I was so glad that you've mentioned that, because when I saw that listed as well as one of the goals that he was going to have, I thought, how the heck do you actually go into an individual student's personal circumstances as to how they view borrowing, how much money that they or their parents have saved or earned towards college, et cetera?
The only piece he can really affect is, do they keep tuition low? All of the other parts are out of his control. So that'll be interesting to watch.
As we look forward to his tenure, Jenna, tell us a little bit about the UNC system today. How would you evaluate it in terms of its challenges?
I think the biggest challenge is COVID.
Really?
What will universities look like in the fall in terms of revenue and in terms of logistics? And I think that those two kind of both of those challenges are going to be ones we have to watch and that Peter is going to have to take on.
We're going to have you back to talk a little bit more about this as we learn more specifics about how he will be evaluated. Jenna Robinson is the president of the Martin Center for Academic Renewal. Thanks, Jenna.
Thank you, Donna.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.